Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 2012 Johns Hopkins Foreign Affairs Symposium. It is my honor to welcome you here tonight as we embark on the second of seven events that will examine the paradox of progress, or mainly the idea that even as our society progresses, we somehow find ourselves enduring repeated crises like the 2008 financial crisis and the resulting economic stagnation. As we attempt to deal with these crises, it's obviously pertinent for us to re-examine the ideas of progress and the idealization of that progress. And as we've done that as a nation in the past year, the Occupy Wall Street movement has been essential in offering us clarity in that reflection. So without further ado, I will introduce you to Kate Khatib, who is the facilitator of the Occupy Baltimore, or I should say the best facilitator that we have in Occupy Baltimore. So she's going to come up here. She's going to talk to you guys about the unique format of this event and how we can both learn from them and engage with them rather than just listen in a stark panel format.
Okay, well, hi, everybody. Welcome. It is great to be here with you tonight. As Andrew mentioned, my name is Kate Khatib. I'm a member of Occupy Baltimore, and I'm also the co-editor of a book of Occupy stories called We Are Many, Reflections on Movement Strategy from Occupation to Liberation, that's forthcoming later this year. I have been asked by the board of the Foreign Affairs Symposium here at Hopkins to play the role of facilitator tonight. That means that my job is to keep the discussion moving, to keep us on point, to bring a little bit of the flavor of an Occupy General Assembly into Shriver Hall tonight. Now, this panel is meant to bring a broad representation of the Occupy movement here to you, but Occupy, the movement of the 99%, is hard to represent, as you might expect. What does it mean to speak for the 99%? What does it mean to speak as a member, as a part of the 99%? Is Occupy a single movement, or is it a collection of movements that are acting and reacting in relation to each other, or is it something that's really even wholly different from that? Lester Spence, who is a professor of political science here at Johns Hopkins, has challenged the notion of Occupy just recently as an ever-expanding single site and has suggested instead that its model become one of proliferation. To be a part of the 99% is not to be the same. It's our differences that make us strong, and it's our ability to recognize and to respect those differences that gives us power. But it's also our willingness to work together despite our differences that gives us a future. And tonight, these seven panelists are going to bring some of those differences into the light, and we'll see what we can make of that. So we're joined tonight by Michael Primo from Occupy Wall Street, by Jonathan Cronin from Occupy Austin, from Artem Raskin from Occupy UC Davis, Larry Swetman from Occupy Philly, Benzo Tweet, Benjamin Phillips from Occupy Oakland, Kevin Zees from Occupy DC, and our very own Joy Davis from Occupy Baltimore. Now, we're going to begin tonight by asking the panelists to each make some introductory remarks to kind of begin to weave a narrative of where Occupy came from and where it might go in the future. We're going to then do our best to run the program kind of in the style of a general assembly. We're going to let the panelists kind of demonstrate what that looks like by giving them a chance to respond to each other, raising their hands to be placed on what we call a stack, which is basically the list in which they're going to speak, and then they're going to speak in turn. And then we're going to open the floor for comments from all of you. We're going to ask that you come up to these microphones when we're ready to take comments from the audience, and we're going to ask that you wait until you're called on to speak so we can keep things orderly. We're also going to ask you to limit your comments, one question apiece, and please try and keep it to questions or very short comments. If you hit the 1 minute mark, I'm going to start giving you this signal, which means move it along, and we really have to ask you to respect that. Because what we're trying to do is get as many different voices out here as possible. Now, on that note, you may have noticed that we do have a little bit of a lack of gender diversity on this panel. It just kind of worked out that way. But what I'm going to do for that reason is I'm going to actually weight the voices of women when we get to the portion where we're going to call comments from the audience. And I'm going to use a form of stacking or a form of facilitation that's called progressive stack. So that means I'm going to weight the voices of people that we haven't heard much from. I'm going to call people who haven't spoken before, things like that. And we're going to ask you to respect that because it's what allows us to get as many different folks out, as many different ideas out as possible. And finally, you're going to notice all of us using a series of hand signals to help guide the discussion, and we're going to encourage you all to actually participate in that. So the most important thing for these folks up here, raise your hand. That's how you're going to get on the stack. I'm going to call folks once I see their hands up. You're going to see me using this, which means move it along. It's not something that's meant as a slam on anybody. It's not a commentary on what they're saying. It just means that you've reached the end of the time that's been allotted to you. The panelists are going to use a point of information, which is just putting one finger up in the air like this. And what that means is there's a factual point that actually needs to be corrected here. It's used very sparingly, but they may need to use it at various points in the conversation. And then the last thing, and this is a place where we're really, really hoping to see all of you participating, is with twinkles or temperature checks. So you're going to see folks doing this or this. That's a sign of assent. That means, yeah, totally. I totally agree with what you're saying. And you might feel silly the first time that you do it, but it's actually a really useful tool because it gives us and you a visual cue on what's going on in the audience and how people are feeling. You might also use this, which is like, you know, I'm not sure what I think about that. It's okay. And then the last one is this, which is downward twinkles. That's a kind of like, no, I'm not really into that. And really, honestly and truly, we do encourage you to do that. Do it respectfully, but please do it to give the panelists up here a sense of how you're feeling about the things that they are saying. So with that, I'm going to call Michael Primo from Occupy Wall Street. He's going to start us off tonight. Michael?
Peace. How you guys doing? All right. I want to thank the organizers for putting together this event, for having the opportunity to come and build with other folks from the movement as well as with you folks this evening. As she said, my name is Michael Primo. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, or Brooklyn, USA, as you like to say. And I'm an activist, I'm an artist, and I'm an organizer. I've been in the mix on Occupy Wall Street since Jump. And going to talk a little bit about sort of some of the things that in my experience and our experience on the ground in New York really sort of were the fabric of what we saw sort of ignite this movement. I think what was really exciting about the initial on September 17th and that first day in the park was this act of standing up in a way that was different than any sort of other activism and or organizing I've been a part of. I think what was unique about the Occupy movement, or the genesis of the Occupy movement, was the fact that we were reclaiming public space. And why why Occupy Wall Street worked is because the particular park that we reclaimed for the community was a space that sort of is in this blurry line between public ownership and private ownership. And it worked, in my opinion, in my critique, and I'll just preface everything I say as just my opinion and my opinion alone. I speak as a member of a movement and not for a movement. And what was exciting about the first few days that set off the Occupy movement was the fact that people were taking without asking. I think the brilliance of the American experience is that protest in a lot of ways is nullified by the act of applying for a permit in order to do a quiet little march along the side of the street. So the power system can be like, oh, look, everything's okay. This isn't Russia, right? Or some obscure, you know, arcane reference to some country we want to demonize, right? And so the act of coming together, in my opinion, in my critique, in a lot of ways, unlocked people's radical creative imagination to think differently about how we can come together in a different sort of way to find new problems, to find new solutions to stubborn old problems. The act of gathering together in a public square provided a forum for people to come together. Many of you are aware of the mic check and the people's microphone, the act of people repeating what's being said, that was a practical innovation of them not allowing us to use amplification. But the unintended consequence was that it provided the emotional like connection that many of us in our culture, because our culture is so commodified, we were so individualized and separated from each other, this created a forum to create emotional connection between our brothers and sisters and community members, right? And people who had many different perspectives, many different ideas, many different values, but who were all sort of united around this common cause of inequality and inequity. What's different about Occupy that's significant is Occupy is a value-based proposition rather than an issue-focused demand. And what was unique about that is it was people coming together that said there is a structural problem in our societies. And that structural problem is that we privilege profit over people and that we need to come together to figure out how we address that fundamental problem. The analogy I use for the Occupy movement is that the Occupy movement is the shape of an octopus. An octopus, the head of the octopus was the physical tactic of occupation in which we were reclaiming public space for community use. But connected to those, the head of the octopus, which is amorphous, which is sort of like composed of all different sort of people from all different sort of backgrounds and value bases and stripes and religious and cultural and political persuasions, allowed us to open up the social and political space to make way for the tentacles of the octopus. And the tentacles of the octopus represent the many different issues and focuses and communities that are now allowed this space to come together to think about how we can think about our problems together. One of the sort of brilliances of the nonprofit industrial complex, as you will, is it's segmented and it's siloed all of our issues based on sort of gender politics, identity politics, or class-based politics, and didn't allow an environment to really create a sophisticated structural critique about how all these things are related and how we can really address power directly by creating counterpower or dual power, as is often called, to at once create an alternative while also attacking existing power dynamics, right? And so those many tentacles, one of those tentacles that I'm particularly involved in as it relates to housing and the liberation of land. I organize with a human rights frame, which is based on that fundamental principle that we need to privilege people versus profit. And that tentacle that I'm particularly engaged in is around the liberation of land for community control. One of the things that has grown out of Occupy that we created, it started fermenting in early October and is now referred to as Occupy Homes, which is a nationwide effort to connect the existing struggles of liberating land for community control within communities to this larger Occupy movement. Some of the things that we've done is we've started this action to institute a people's bailout, which is a moratorium on all foreclosures. And we've begun to do this by writing a song. We wrote a song, and we sing that song in foreclosure courts. We sing that song so that they cannot sell any of these houses. We've shut down 3 auctions so far in New York. It's been replicated in San Diego, Denver, and Tampa so far, with Gainesville, somewhere in Seattle, Oregon, and Michigan on their way. Right, and so I mentioned that to illustrate how these sort of larger ideals of this value-based movement can relate directly to strategic goals that we can obtain within communities to be able to sort of what I say liberate the impossible, which is what Occupy really is providing us an opportunity to do. Thank you.
What's the song?
Yeah, sing it, man.
I'll sing it later.
Okay, next up, Jonathan Cronin from Occupy Austin.
Good evening, Baltimore, and my name is Jonathan Cronin. I'm from Austin, Texas, where I'm a sociology major. First off, before I get too involved in trying to follow up Michael here, I do want to give my sincere thanks to the Johns Hopkins University community and the Foreign Affairs Symposium for arranging this event, and I think it's crucial that people knew to the idea of the movement as a tactic and as a general movement towards of empowerment, that I think it's great that people are able to see a variety of different opinions brought forth here. To follow up on the housing aspect of this, there's been a national drive within the movement to reallocate money from local corporate bank branches into local credit unions. Specifically in Austin, this has been very successful, even without going into the minority communities where there's a heavy concentration of the 99%. And that's something we have a lot of work left ahead to do to address locally in Austin in terms of outreach. But despite that, we've been able to remove locally $1.57 million from local corporate bank branches into the credit unions. Mm. So it really speaks to the power that we've been able to generate in Austin, but also speaks to the potential that we have left ahead of us. I do want to think back to September when I was first getting into the mix of this, and the buzz and the energy and the enthusiasm that was cultivated through social media. We did not know how many people were going to be showing up at our first General Assembly. We scheduled it at a coffee house in South Austin called Brood of Maya Coffee House, and it's a great place to go. Come to Austin, visit, have fun. We packed that place with 500 people. After 500, we stopped counting, and I think even the fire department showed up to make sure we were within code. But that's been our success locally in Austin, and I know that the National Credit Union Administration put out some figures in probably October or November demonstrating the national momentum that had been created, somewhere over over a billion dollars national. On a national scale, had been removed from those corporate bank branches into credit unions, and I think over a million people had participated in that facilitation at that point, and I'd be curious to see what the new numbers are of late. But my personal remarks about the movement so far, and I'm not speaking for Occupy Austin again, just as an individual with my personal assessment, there's been an amazing thing about seeing people being engaged in grassroots activism for the first time ever and being mm-hmm. able to sense that mm-hmm. personal grasp with power. Mm-hmm. And this movement is about, you know, changing the balance in the equation of power. And so there's going to be a lot of ups and downs here, and there's going to be a lot of education, a lot of learning amongst individuals catching up with stuff like war, foreign policy, economic inequality, and so on and so forth. But to see the personal growth of people who are arriving to grassroots activism for the first time ever has been very inspiring for me as someone who's been involved with issues for the past decade or so, and it really speaks to the power that we have once we get engaged in these issues and assert the power that we all have within. So I'll pass it on here. Thank you.
Okay, next up, Artem Raskin from UC Davis.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Let's try that again. Mic check.
Mic check.
There we go. All right, so I'm Artem Raskin from UC Davis. I'd like to echo the thanks to the organizers of this event. I think it's great. And so jumping into the speech, if you guys saw the PDF description of this event, you will have noticed that UC Davis was represented by a photo that's become, excuse me, mic is, all right. The photo that's become, is that too loud?
No, you're fine.
All right, yeah. The photo that's become fairly well known, which was the photo of Officer Pike pepper spraying UC Davis students. Show of hands, how many of you have seen that? Here we go, that's what I thought. Now, so, almost everyone has seen the photo and knows about the pepper spraying. What's less known is why we were actually having the protest. And the protest was held in solidarity with the UC Berkeley students who were beaten by police a few days prior. That tends to get left out. And the UC Berkeley students got some news coverage, but it petered off quite quickly. About a month or 2 months later, UC Riverside students were shot with rubber bullets by police when they had their local action, which got almost no coverage. So the question is, why did UC Davis get so much attention relative to the other universities which experienced similar problems? And I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that the pepper spraying is photogenic. It creates a cool meme. The Officer Pike meme looks cool. Bullets are very difficult to photograph, so they don't attract as much attention, which means that I think that what was unique about UC Davis was not necessarily the pepper spraying. Especially in poor communities in the United States, pepper spraying is ubiquitous. But what was unique about UC Davis, rather, was the media attention that it got. So let's talk about the media narrative that was created. Well, I think there are two things. First of all, I think the media narrative was created, first of all, by the fact that it was photogenic. Second of all, by the fact that it was students, primarily white, primarily upper class, who were pepper sprayed. That was the unusual thing that happened, as opposed to the pepper spraying that goes invisible in other communities. But the media attention, which most people saw as a boon for the United for UC Davis, was actually more nuanced than that, which is that I think that a lot of the narrative that comes out of UC Davis was not created by UC Davis occupiers, but rather by the media covering the event, which is why we hear a lot about the pepper spraying and almost nothing about the protest and the causes of that protest or any subsequent actions that UC Davis has done, such as the bank blockade, for instance, which I thought was on the ground a lot more effective. So the media narrative did several things. First of all, it focused very clearly on police and demonized the UC Davis police and Officer Pike and Spicuzza in particular, which on one hand is understandable, right? I mean, they obviously shouldn't have pepper sprayed, and it's not okay to do that. On the other hand, the media missed a lot of the systemic problems that led to the pepper spraying, which are that University of California police are answerable to UC regents who run the entire university system as an unelected body serving 12-year terms and appointed by the governor in exchange for campaign contributions, which basically means that the UC Davis police is not democratically accountable to UC Davis students anyway. And that was completely ignored. And actually, today was the day that a task force report was supposed to come out about this incident, and the police union blocked the release of the task force report, and the UC Davis chancellor, Chancellor Katihi, who's, I think, directly responsible for the pepper spraying, has expressed her outrage at the fact that the task force report was blocked. So I think that at the point where the chancellor, who is where we're fighting, ends up on our side, is indicative of the fact that the narrative that was created was not beneficial for us, right? She wanted the task force reports to come out to pin the blame even more on police and distance herself from the police, which I think we should be mindful of. And as a larger point, I think that what happened was that we got a lot of media attention, and then, of course, the media got bored of it and moved on to something else. And the impression that that creates is that there was a really big Occupy movement, and then it petered out. And I think that's true for Occupy movement in general. It got a lot of media coverage back in the fall, and is getting a lot less media coverage now, which I think is problematic because we were so glad that, you know, we were big. I got, like, phone calls from Russia and from Al Jazeera, you know, makes you feel big. But I think that relying too much on that media-created momentum is problematic because it's fickle and it's going to go away. And the movement must stay and rely on grassroots organization to keep the attention of the people rather than relying on the media. So that's the media narrative. I also want to talk about the narratives that we create within Occupy by ourselves to draft our own message, and I think that's problematic as well. So some of you might know, when there was a rebellion in Libya, the rebels asked for Gaddafi to step aside and resign, and Gaddafi's response was, I would resign, but so it turns out that I don't actually have an official position. I'm just a lowly colonel, and I don't know, people just come to me for advice a lot. Which is, I think, symptomatic, because if you guys look into the history of Libya and the history of the Libyan rebellion, Gaddafi's Green Book, his political philosophy, most of that's taken out straight out of Bakunin, the anarchist philosopher, and is very similar to the way that Occupy is built. So when Occupy pushes the narrative that it's a leaderless movement, this is a horizontal movement, and tries to use that narrative to counteract the media narratives, I think that it's a good idea to look at the real-world examples of how that narrative plays out in the long term. And I think that on one hand, we do want to remain horizontal and leaderless and so on. On the other hand, I think that when we stop being leaderless, it's a good idea to acknowledge that. I think that there are certain positions within Occupy, such as media contacts, such as treasurer, that are real power positions. And I think that until we acknowledge that they exist, it will be almost impossible to get rid of them in the same way that Gaddafi's apparent lack of power made it more difficult to get rid of him.
Thank you. Okay, next up, Larry Sweatman from Occupy Philly.
My brother here stole my mic check gimmick. I'm not too happy about that, but I'm going to keep going. I want to echo what has been said so far about my thankfulness and my John Hopkins setting this up and the panel. You all are doing fantastic work. This is I'm quite honored to be here. In the interest of transparency and adhering to the principles of the movement, I want to be up front with you all. I'm going to give you a very short history of what's gone on in Philly, and then I'm going to seek to inspire you to action. That's my goal in my 5 minutes here, because we all have to do this together. And that's why I was going to go with the mic check to show our togetherness. But let's just assume it, shall we? We feel good about that? Assuming togetherness? Feel good about that. Okay, so if I was going to talk about Philly, I could tell you about the Wells Fargo that we shut down for a day. I could tell you how we ran Eric Cantor out of town. I could tell you how we scared Bill Clinton enough that he didn't want to come to town. I could tell you about a bridge that we shut down. And I could also tell you about the horses that trampled some of our people during our eviction. But I don't want to do that. I want to use those very quick examples to create an image in your mind of what happens in Philly, and then I want to try to relate that to something bigger, which involves all of us in this room, around this country, and around this world. Our fabulous facilitator here mentioned, first off, that the idea behind Occupy, and I think Michael kind of alluded to this as well, is coming together and working within our difference. There's an interesting philosophical question in this movement that's ages old, and that's the one in the many. How can we be autonomous and function in an accountable structure collectively? Because the only way we're going to move forward, the only way we are going to change things, is together. This movement will, as long as it lives, and you know, long live the occupation, but as long as it is around, it will always be fought at a local level. Baltimore's concerns are very different from Philly's concerns, which are very different from Oakland's concerns. And we've got to be mindful of that, while at the same time appreciating our sameness and our common enemy. Nothing unifies like a common enemy. Mm-hmm. And once we all in this country, in this world, wake up and realize that this corporatocracy and this financial system is a giant that has nailed us to the ground and kept us there with systems purposefully to make sure that we don't threaten their power, then that's when we get angry. And that's when we become a force of change. Mm-hmm. And so when we are fighting at this local level, we can have this very broad-minded view, but then funnel it down to a locally specific issue. And that's what this movement's done very well. We have been able to kind of figure out what our local issues are. In Philadelphia, it's Wells Fargo. They're bad people. And so we go after them. they steal from people, they're racists, and they have taken the futures away from our children. And so, but that's just a microcosm of this bigger financial question. So I hope that that very brief description convinced you all of this kind of one in the many aspect of this movement, because now I want to move into very specifically the many. I have been working with an entity called InterOccupy, which is a collection of people from around the movement, which is completely volunteer-based, and we have built a communication infrastructure and provided tools that the movement can use to communicate and to coordinate with each other so that when these big issues do come up, for example, I don't know if you all have realized, but the government is thinking about bombing Iran. That's something that we need to do something about. And we need mechanisms that are in place that give us the ability to communicate and coordinate on that level. And that's what we try to do at InterOccupy. And we do that in two main areas, one of which is the Committee of Correspondence, which is basically open and inclusive working groups that adhere to the principles of local general assemblies who are dedicated to communicating with other occupations. By doing this, we utilize a sociological construct called a small network model of communication. And what that does is it basically cuts down on the noise. Like Philly can talk to Baltimore very, very easily and transmit information. And that's one way that we stay in contact with each other, which is very kind of broad. Again, these big issues that we're talking about. But now, once we come back down to this local level in Philly, if we need to get to Wells Fargo, or in Baltimore, we need to get to, who's the enemy in Baltimore? Bank of America. Actually, I will tell you exactly how you can all implement this tomorrow. When we get down to this local level, we need support. And what we do is at InterOccupy, we have a call request service that people, anybody who's involved in a working group in a local assembly can request a call. For example, there have been calls for the November 17th National Day of Action that you may have heard about, the port shutdown, which you may have heard about, the Oakland Solidarity Marches, which you may have heard about. And I keep repeating that phrase is because it's what we've heard about. These things, these momentous moves, have come through active and passionate communication and coordination on a bigger level while focusing on local issues, which is very, very important. This is a very, very big country. That's the reason we can't get together in one place and just make a stand, because there's just too many of us and too much space. And so I'm kind of getting lost in my rambling here. Let me check my notes. But I get passionate. I'm sorry. Okay. But the last point I want to make is that this makes a difference. Again, I alluded to the port shutdown, November 17th, Oakley Solidarity, and Occupy Homes that Michael alluded to earlier. These are all aspects where national coordination has helped inspire people. And that's what we've got to do. We've got to inspire people into participation. That's what I'm trying to do with you people right now. That's what everybody here is trying to do with everybody in this country right now, is trying to inspire us to action. And it's working. I'm not sure that if you folks have read the news in the past 2 days, but they moved G8 from Chicago to Camp David. You know why they did that?
Us.
Yeah, come on. Give me some more twinkles, people. Give me some participation. All right. They moved G8 because we were going to have a lot of people outside of the G8, and they're scared of that. When we come together and we have and we start functioning not in unity, because we have to maintain our diversity, but when we can start acting in solidarity, then we will become a force of change that they cannot stop, because that's how you bring a giant to its knees. Thank you.
That work, are you all feeling inspired? Yeah? All right, we're getting there. Good job. Okay, so next up from Occupy Oakland, from Oakland, Benzo Tweet, Benjamin Phillips.
Where's Wallace? Where's Wallace? Nobody watches The Wire? I'm in Baltimore. It's terrible. All right. So I guess I don't usually give speeches. I'm on the Occupy Oakland media team, so we focus on doing like social media, so like Twitter, blogs, live streaming. So this isn't really my environment, so bear with me. But we were talking earlier about media cycles, and I'm in Iraq Veterans Against the War, and I don't know how many of you have seen the video of Scott Olson, the Scott Olson incident, and So that's one of those things where it's like this huge epic media event, and then, you know, like a couple months later, it's like, oh yeah, I remember that. You know, I remember that happened. But for me, it's like I see this guy like all the time. So it's really kind of bizarre, you know, from my experience to see this. One of the reasons why we focus on social media is because there are no media cycles in social media. So it's like, how many times have you posted something on Facebook, right? And then like a year later, you see the same thing posted, and you're like, wait a minute, you didn't see that yet? You know, it's like, that's because there's no news cycles in social media. In social media, news is what's ever new to you. And it's a way to build relationships between people that you can't do through like mass media. So some people might say, you know, like, oh, Occupy Oakland, why don't you negotiate with the government? Well, we don't negotiate with the government because we don't have to prove that we are a legitimate political movement. The government has to prove that they are a legitimate government. In this, I didn't make that up, by the way. It's the same way with the mainstream media. Like, we don't have to prove that we're a legitimate news source. The news has to prove they're a legitimate news source, and they fail consistently. So that's why we focus on the tools that we have to tell our own stories and to put it out there. Let me check my notes here. So the kind of the environment that we're in has really, I think, and again, I just want to preface everything I'm saying that I'm not speaking on behalf of Occupy Oakland or the Occupy movement. I'm just a supporter, and I've been involved for some time. So that's that. But like these things that we have in our, everyone has in their pocket, right? These cell phones. I mean, we look at these things like they're a toy, like we play Angry Birds on it. But this isn't a toy. This is a weapon. This is a weapon. The government robbed everyone. The banks robbed everyone. And then they handed us AK-47s. And that's what we have in our pocket. This is a weapon. And no one really realized that until the police started tear gassing us and shooting us. And then we were live streaming it from our phones. We were live tweeting. We were taking video. We were posting to YouTube on the spot while it was happening. We were connecting with people internationally. I mean, I'm getting tear gas in Oakland, and there's a person getting tear gas in Syria, and we're talking at the same time. And the same weapons manufacturers are making the tear gas. The environment, they're like giving this to us. It's like they're handing this revolution on a silver platter. It's pretty amazing. There are all these tools that business uses. My day job is I do Salesforce administration. It's a customer relations management system. And so I go to all these conferences, and it's a trip because these, like, you know, tech conferences, they're huge events, and we'll go to like 9 hours of, you know, Twitter is the future and social media is the future. And then we leave, and then people are trading business cards. Like, I have a Rolodex on my desk, you know what I mean? Business gets it. They get it conceptually. They can make the tools, but they cannot implement it because their structures of the organization will allow them to. But we naturally do that. When I meet somebody, I don't say, do you have a card at Occupy Oakland? I say, are you on Twitter? Are you on Facebook? That's how we're able to organize ourselves so effectively and grow so quickly. That they make these tools for us. They just don't realize it. So like in business, you know, there's like, there's like sales and marketing. There are like these two parts in business. In sales, they do like lead gen, and marketing, they do customer relations management. So it's like you have to meet people, and then you get them on a phone, and then somebody talks to them, and they try to sell them a computer or whatever it is. For us, we use Twitter and Facebook. And Twitter isn't really about sales. It's not about like doing outreach. Like, that doesn't exist for us. It's about visibility. It's about saying, and that's why, you know, I introduced myself as Benzo Tweet, because that's my Twitter name, because I'm trying to be visible to people that are interested in me. So the visibility part of it is that you do you make yourself just apparent to people. So, you know, you figure like you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a best friend or something like that. Like, what's the chances that you met? You know, how many other people are there out there that you could meet and they would be your girlfriend or your boyfriend or your best friend or whatever? There's like 7 billion people on the planet. How many people do you think you can marry? You know, and so that's the point of what we're doing, right? No, I'm serious. It's all about like creating visibility around yourself and what you're interested in, because there are 1,000 people in this area that are like you, that you can meet and that you can be friends with, that share your values, that share your goals, and share your aspirations. The point is to be visible to them. And then once you're visible to them, we use Facebook as a way to keep track of them. So it's like, how many times did somebody wish you a happy birthday before Facebook? You know? And now it's like, you see this little thing and it pops up on your screen, right? And it says, oh, you know, so-and-so's birthday is this week. Here's 7 people's birthdays this week. And by the way, here's a Kenny Powers t-shirt that you can, you know, maybe get them for their birthday or whatever. You know, it's like they, and it's like used for these crass commercial purposes. But when you look at it, like what this is, it's a technological infrastructure that allows you to build an organization that requires no training, that's completely free, and that it, everyone has. So so that's why we're focusing on that. And you know, locally, nationally, internationally, and I'll just wrap this up with this, is that the same thing that's true like for Oakland or for nationally is true internationally. And that's why I think that this environment really has gives us the potential for a true global revolution and universal human liberation. So that's it.
Okay, Joy Davis, Occupy Baltimore.
Hello. I like you too.
Okay. My name is Joy Davis. I was there October 4th when we encamped at McKeldin Square, and I've been working with Occupy ever since. It's very important to me. What I'm going to be talking about is outreach, because I am on the outreach committee, and talking a little bit more about local issues here in the city, and really about how we are a small group, but we've really pulled together and come up with some really great actions. So I'm going to start with outreach. When we started, we had McKeldin Square, and we were able to go out into communities not very similar to campaigning when they go outreaching, but just talking to people about the issues that they felt that contributed to kind of the crisis that we're having, not just foreclosures, not just high student loans, but their jobs are being, you know, taken away from them, especially if they're working with the post office or with libraries or in schools. This allowed us to really make connections with people in the community, which is super duper important. I know that everyone touched a little bit about local issues, but the big thing that local issues do is connect people that might have an interest in Occupy or might have an interest in activism to doing some work, getting work done. Because that's usually probably if you were on the square and you were talking to people, they would always ask, you know, or on your respective places and your occupations, what are you actually doing now in the community? I see you out here, but what are you doing over there? And we really had to think about that as Occupy Baltimore. From my perspective, again, I can't really speak for everyone with Occupy or with Occupy Baltimore, but I saw a change that happened towards local issues almost immediately after we were evicted. We looked at overdevelopment with the Baltimore Development Corporation and how they're using TIFs and pilots to bring in, you know, corporate America, which isn't actually benefiting the city. It's doing a lot of damage. So we were able to bring attention to that and put a lot of pressure on them. Occupy our homes. We've had several cases that we've been very successful in bringing awareness to the housing crisis, but also, again, bringing communities together. Our first case was Lila Kara, and what we did was actually canvass to not only churches, but the local community. We also attempted to give a presentation to the community organization in the area, and that really brought a lot of people out. But it's not just about numbers to make a scene. And to just bring attention to that there was a lot of people here, or a lot of people got arrested. It's really important in any community, even if you are in a college campus, that you are aware of the issues going around you and the tools that you can use. Because we can talk about national issues and they're great, and you know, overdevelopment and for the foreclosure crisis are part of the national narrative, but it's really important that we are getting work done. So when you say you're with Occupy, so what have you done? You can go through this laundry list. And I'm going to do that right now. So we challenged the BDC. We've been very successful with Occupy Our Homes. Schools Not Jailed action happened recently. It was pulled off very well. Also, we had the March for Jobs, Occupy for Jobs, which is a great working group. It's been very successful. They also, for Occupy Congress, marched down to D.C., so that was pretty cool. The other thing about schools, not jails, and another, I think, interesting thing that no one seemed to touch on yet is that we are bringing together other organizations, other grassroots organizations, which is important. Another thing about connecting to your community, because it's great that we can be Occupy, and we can say we slept in tents, but it's important that people are connecting with us. And I hope we can do that, and we can kind of have a national effort to push ourselves into communities as well. So also with solidarity with the Baltimore Algebra Project, we did Schools Not Jails, which brought attention to the youth jail site. We were able to push it off of the budget for 2013, so hopefully we can be successful and continue to push it off of the budget. We recently found out we're in a $52 million deficit, so hopefully they don't think that a $100 million youth jail is necessary. Where are we going? I guess I can talk about that and how the community should be involved and is getting involved. We conducted a spring planning GA recently on Saturday. We really discussed like the future and how we can move into communities doing outreach again, like I said, but also how to bring maybe attention back to McKeldin Square and doing events, there. Recently after we got de-encamped, we were evicted, we did Occupy Franklin Street and I see Athena. She was really integral in bringing attention to the post office closings that are happening. It's really affecting Maryland, but it is going to be affecting the whole nation. And what they're doing is taking post offices out of rural areas as well as disenfranchised areas, low-income areas. These are areas that need infrastructure, but at least for Baltimore in this city, they are constantly depleting infrastructure, so we want to work on that. Okay, I see you have that time. The last thing I wanted to mention coming up this Saturday at the school board on North Avenue, they are protesting against the closing of a high school in Cherry Hill. It is their only high school. These are the things locally that we're doing, but that's not to just brag about what we're doing. It's to say that please get out into your community. Even if you don't agree with Occupy, it is so important to include yourself in your own community, talk with your friends and family, and maybe set up your own, like, your own protest, your own event, because it's not just about us, it's about you challenging the status quo. Thank you.
And Kevin Zees, Occupy DC.
All right, thank you. I'm actually from Baltimore, but I haven't been involved in Occupy Baltimore because I started organizing Occupy Washington, D.C. at Freedom Plaza last April before Occupy Wall Street began. We started to get inspired by Madison, Wisconsin, occupying their Capitol building and Tahrir Square and the Spanish Real Democracy Movement. So we started organizing because we were frustrated with the real failure of our political process to hear us. We wanted to find some way to do that. We saw that by occupying public space, you also occupy part of the political dialogue. So I've been very involved in Occupy Washington, D.C., and not so involved in Occupy Baltimore. I've watched it, and I've been impressed by it. You guys have done great work up here, and I really appreciate it. I want to talk a little about goals, strategies, and tactics. You've heard a lot has already been accomplished. I mean, you've heard successes of closing down banks, of moving money from big banks to community banks and credit unions. We're actually having an impact saving people's homes and keeping people in their homes when foreclosures are coming. We're doing great stuff. And we're doing great stuff nationally. You may remember the Super Committee was there to solve the deficit, and Obama was talking openly the first time a president who was a Democrat talking about this, cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare. The Republicans and Democrats are plotting how they're going to do it to save the deficit. And the Occupy and working with others stopped that. We had one person from Freedom Plaza who got up in front of that deficit committee, that super committee, stood in the well to their faces with C-SPAN watching, telling them they were lying to the public. The deficit is caused by the military-industrial complex, our incredible waste on weapons and war, as much as the whole world combined, and on our failure to go after the 1% where the money is. The 400 richest people in this country have wealth equal to 154 million Americans. We know where the money is. It's been going there for 30 years. It's time for us to put in place policies to take it back, and that's about our goal. Our goal is to shift power. shift power from the 1% to the 99%, to move away from an oligarchy to a real participatory democracy, and to democratize our economy. That's what the goal is, in my view at least, is to shift that kind of power to the people. End corporate rule, shift power to the people. The way you change things as a nonviolent movement, and we are a nonviolent movement, I'll talk about that in a little bit, the way you change things is not new. There's been now 100 years of modern nonviolent strategy and tactics, and there's a great website with the Albert Einstein Institute, the aeinstein.org website, which provides books you can download for free on how nonviolent movements shift power. In looking at that, what we see basically is our goal is to win the hearts and minds of the people. It's to build our movement and weaken the power structure. The power structure you can envision as columns holding the current power in place. Those columns include military, police, workers, media, youth, religious institutions, nonprofits, civil servants. Those kinds of, there's about nine pillars that hold power in place. Our job is to weaken those pillars by pulling people in the power structure to our side. Not necessarily by having conflict and seeking conflict with them. We will definitely use civil resistance as part of our tactics. But the goal is to bring those people to our side. We want the police to know that they are not the 1%, that the world we're going to create is better for them and their families. We want the military to know that. We want the media to know that. We want the media to know that being part of a shrinking Baltimore Sun that's owned by someone in Illinois is not as good as owning the newspaper yourself as a writer or as an editor. Worker ownership will give them more power and make it a more effective newspaper. And will also protect them from shrinkage when the conglomerate decides they don't want to put money into it. And that's what's happening in Baltimore, as we all know. And you can hear the talk we already talked about. What we're doing in shifting power is sometimes building an alternative structure. And in the media, for example, what we're doing is we've been a long history now of independent media has developed over the last 20 years. But more importantly, more recently, is the democratized media. We all have these weapons of mass communication. You know, we all have Facebook and Twitter and blogs and email lists and social media contacts. The 175 people in this room, if we act together with intention, we can reach more people than the Baltimore Sun. We can reach more people than most local TV stations. And if we add another 100 or so, we can probably reach more people than any of the cable news outlets. Well, most of those have 100,000 to 500,000 viewers, that's all. With our networks acting intentionally, we can be the media. We are at the virtual tipping point of media control if we become aware of it and act like it with intention. And that's building an alternative structure. That's weakening the power structure of the military, of the media. And it's creating a new media outlet. I saw there's a group of people in the corporate media who are frustrated by it, and they're setting up a website and creating their own media outlet. We see investigative reporters from the Baltimore Sun creating their own media outlets as part of independent media. That's part of building the power structure on our side, pulling people over. And when you look at how you do this, you have to think carefully about strategy and what it means. For example, with the police. If we had taken an approach of being violent with police, we wouldn't have a movement. Think about it. Occupy Wall Street begins. There's a couple thousand people show up on September 17th. About 100 or so people spend the night in Zuccotti Park. That's not a very big movement. But they struggled through it. They persisted. Persistence is a key phase of success. And they persisted through it. And the key thing that happened, though, was there's a protest in Union Square Park, and a few people were arrested, and they were being held behind those orange mesh cages, and a police officer came up and pepper sprayed them in the face. They were not doing anything violent. They were not doing anything threatening. They were only under arrest. If they had been throwing batteries at the police, throwing apples at the police, cursing the police, then there'd be sympathy for the police. But instead, when that Officer Bologna, sprayed those women in the face, you heard a blue-collar officer say, "Wow, I can't believe he just sprayed those women in the face." Even right then, you saw a division. Their column was weakening. By being nonviolent, we weakened that column. Same with the UC Davis folks. So we're making this progress. We've had some tremendous successes, and there's a lot more ahead. And I just want to finish one last point. This is coming at a time where the Occupy is not the only group acting. This has been going on for a while. Go back to the WTO in Seattle. When we started to set up the Occupy and Freedom Plaza, we looked at outlets across the country of YouTube pages. There are protests against corporate power going on constantly that the media doesn't report. What we did was bring it all together, bring it to the public. And this is all happening at a time when what people have called for about 10 years now a great turning. We're moving from a competitive, capitalist, dog-eat-dog, disastrous economy to a cooperative one where we work together to solve common problems. And that's what the Occupy is about, and that's what we're trying to achieve. And we're trying to do it with a sense of strategy and tactics that can actually get us there.